Well, last year I read about a study, and the study showed that despite all our apparent connectedness with social media, etc., that we're actually fracturing at the seams, that we're actually becoming much less connected. And the report said that there's actually a growing epidemic of loneliness in Western countries, that people everywhere are becoming lonelier and lonelier, that they're feeling less and less significant in the eyes of others because of their loneliness. And to be lonely is a tragedy. To be lonely is to feel acutely that you're not known by others, that others are not truly present with you as you're journeying through life, that as far as the rest of the world is concerned, that you're not significant. And to be lonely or to perceive that you have no significance is, according to the study that I read the report about, it's not safe for your health. In fact, the report said that it's as bad for you to be lonely as it is to be obese or to be a smoker. It has the potential to have harm to your health. So loneliness, feeling like you're not meaningfully known by others, it leads to a loss of significance and potentially a loss of safety for your health. But for believers, that need not be the case. In Psalm 139, the psalmist, a believer, is not lonely, or at least he shouldn't be lonely, because he's known and he's accompanied by and he's sustained by the God of the universe. And so because of this, despite what others might think of him, the psalmist has very great significance and actually very great safety. His very awareness that God knows him and sees him, that God is always with him, that God, his maker, holds his very life in his hands, aids his spiritual safety. As we'll see from the psalm, the psalmist is safer from temptation, from the temptation of turning from God, because he realises that he can never actually really escape from God. So Psalm 139 speaks to all believers about our relationship with God. It teaches us that we live all our lives, every second and every moment, before the face of God. It shows us that God knows everything, that God sees everything, that God's always with us, that God, our Maker, actively gives us every breath we take. And so knowing this as believers, it makes us realise that even when we feel lonely or even when we feel insignificant, that we truly are, every one of us truly is of very great significance because we're significant to God. And that in understanding our great significance, there is great spiritual safety. So the psalmist starts very profoundly but very simply in verse 1 by addressing the creator of the universe. He says, O Lord, you have searched me and known me. So all of his life thus far has been lived before the very face of God. And God's knowledge of the psalmist has not been passive. It's actually been very active. We read that God has actively searched him, has had him under the microscope, as it were, that God has seen all of him, all of his life, and therefore God knows him absolutely and knows all about him. It's as if the Lord's got X-ray vision, that he sees everything that happens when the psalmist's at home. We read in verse 2, so he knows when the psalmist sits down and when he rises up. The Lord has his eye on him. A bit like Julie's mum used to keep her eye on great-grandpa. So great-grandpa lived a mile or so across the paddock, and every night he'd have his bath. And Julie's mum would be concerned that he didn't nod off in the bath and drown, or that he didn't slip and break his hip. So she'd, from afar, with the binoculars, she'd watch the light in the window across the paddock. And when she saw the light go out, she knew that great-grandpa was safely out of the bath. From afar, she'd discerned his sitting down in the bath and his rising up again. And God, in searching and therefore knowing the psalmist, has discovered not only what he does in the privacy of his home, but he's even discovered, verse 2b, what he thinks, the good and the bad and the ugly. And God's knowledge of the man extends to activities outside his home. So, verse 3, he knows when he goes out for the day. He searches out his path. and he knows when he returns to lie down in his bed at the evening. He's thoroughly acquainted, we're told, with all his ways. But God not only sees the man's actions and uncovers his thoughts, he also knows in advance every word he utters. So look at verse 4. Even before a word is on my tongue, behold, O Lord, you know it altogether. So friends, here's a man who's absolutely categorically known by God in his actions, in his thoughts and motivations, his words, warts and all. Nothing's private. Everything's laid bare before God. Friends, this believer is of very great significance because he's deeply, intimately, personally known by the God of the whole universe. And this personal knowledge of the psalmist by God is not only comprehensive, it is, as we've seen, very active. And again in verse 5, we see that God's actively involved in his life. So we read, the psalmist says, "You hem me in behind and before and lay your hand upon me." Which for a believer, again, is very comforting. To be hemmed in is to be protected, like the chooks are protected when they're hemmed in at the end of the night in the chook house. They're hemmed in and they're safe from prowling foxes. And to have God's hand laid on you is to know his fatherly protection. But the language of hemmed in also actually has a slightly negative connotation to it as well. So to be hemmed in by God, if you're one who opposes God, if you're one who seeks to run from God and hide from him, is to actually find yourself restricted by him. And similarly, if you're one who opposes God or runs from God, to have his hand upon you is actually like the long arm of the law. You can't outrun it and it's oppressive against you. So God knows and has searched out and sees the psalmist in all his thinking and speaking and actions, and nothing has escaped God's searching gaze. And so the psalmist says, verse 6, that God's knowledge of him is too wonderful or too extraordinary, or it's too high for him. He cannot attain it. God's exhaustive knowledge of this man in all its detail absolutely astounds him, as it would for us too. Friends, God knows each one of us personally, intimately, comprehensively, in all the nitty-gritty, tiny details of our lives. He knows all our best intentions and all our motivations and desires. And he knows and sees the worst in us as well. We're so significant to God that he knows us absolutely. And friends, for believers, God's knowledge of us is actually for our safety, for our spiritual safety. Because even as New Testament believers, even as those who have the Holy Spirit, each one of us, frankly, still has a sinful nature to wrestle with. Our sinful nature wrestles or opposes God's Spirit, we read in Galatians 5:17. So there's this internal war that goes on inside the hearts of believers. So friends, as we know, we're all subject to temptation. And therefore, the very fact that we know that God, from Psalm 139, the very fact that we know God is watching us is indeed a great incentive to flee from temptation rather than to yield. Friends, God's infinite, all-seeing knowledge of us is for our very great spiritual safety. Well, many years ago, I have a number of sisters, as some of you know, and many years ago, a young man in our small town was very keen on one of my sisters. He was so keen that he always wanted to be with her. So he'd come around home all the time just to be with her. And he'd drop into her workplace uninvited just to be with her. And he'd make sure he went to church at the same time, and that he went to young farmers' functions that she went to, and that he'd show up uninvited to family functions. He wanted to be with her so much because she was, frankly, very significant to her, to him, I should say. And actually, this became quite wearing for her in the end, because to her, it seemed like she just couldn't escape anywhere from his presence. But from verse 7, the psalmist reflects on the fact that he literally can't escape from someone's presence. He literally can't escape from God's presence. So the Bible teaches us that God is spirit, we read in John 4:24, and that though he's not part of his creation, that God is always present everywhere at all times throughout his creation. In fact, in Jeremiah 23, verse 24, God declares, Do I not fill the heaven and the earth? So God is at all times present with his people wherever they are, which lends again very great significance to us as his people. So verse 7, where can the psalmist go from God's spirit? Or where shall he flee from God's presence? And the answer, of course, is nowhere. It can't be done. You can't flee from God's presence. So even if he could somehow travel to the highest heights or to the deepest depths in verse 8, even if he could travel all the way to heaven or down to Sheol, the ever-present God is with him. Or even if, verse 9, he took the wings of the morning, that is, if he could travel with the same speed that the dawn spreads around the earth from east to west at 1,000 miles an hour, he still could not escape God's presence. Or if he went and lived over the horizon in the uttermost parts of the sea, verse 9, God would be there right with him. And so the fact that God is always present is, or it should be, a very great comfort for us as believers. And no doubt many of you have found that to be the case. Many of you, when you've gone through difficult and dark times, you've been sustained by this very fact, by the fact that you know that God, your God, is with you. Hebrews 13 verse 5 puts it beautifully. God has said, I will never leave you nor forsake you. We are so significant to God that he is always with us. We can never, even if we wanted to, flee from his presence. And this truth, which not only assures us very much of our great significance to God, it also speaks, doesn't it, again to our spiritual safety. You see, I don't know about every one of you, but frankly, there are times when I wouldn't actually mind if God wasn't around. Even as a believer who in my head wants to do what is right, in my heart, I'm very aware of a spiritual battle. I'm very aware that I'm often inclined to do what is wrong. And my divided heart is not alone. The psalmist, this believer we're reading of in Psalm 139, he has the same struggles with the same divided loyalty in his heart. So he actually speaks in verse 7, surprisingly perhaps, of fleeing God's presence. He says, where can I flee from your presence? And why does he put it like that? Why does he put it so strongly? Well, isn't it simply because there are times in his life, and perhaps in our own lives, when we prefer to do exactly that, to flee God? So why would he say, verse 11, surely the darkness shall cover me, and the light about me be night? Why would he say that unless there are times when he seeks to secretly hide himself in darkness away from God? But of course, again, it's impossible to hide our actions from God, which for us as still prone to sin believers is indeed for our very great spiritual safety. So when I'm tempted, if I purposefully remember, that's right, God is everywhere and God sees everything, and that verse 12, darkness is as light with God, or as Hebrews 4:13 puts it, that everything is exposed before God's ever-watchful gaze, if I remember these things as I should, then I'll be less inclined to give in to temptation. You could put it this way, in a sense, God's like our chaperone, and it's truly a blessing for us as God's people that God's chaperoning hand, verse 10, is with us, wherever we are, leading us in all circumstances. But also for the sake of our spiritual safety, God's strong right hand, we see in verse 10b, is ever present to hold us. And the expression here is a slightly more overt sense, a sense of a more controlling presence of God restraining us. And it is for our spiritual safety. Well, some years ago, a friend of mine did a course in adolescent health, and in the course, the lecturer asked the question, why do so many teenagers feel that they're not worthwhile or that they're not significant? And my friend, who's a very perceptive man, he answered it this way. He says, in a nutshell, they feel insignificant because our culture teaches them that they're insignificant. Our culture teaches them that they're nothing more than a bunch of molecules. Our culture teaches them that their existence is simply an evolutionary biological accident, and that as such, there's no more significance to them being alive at this point than if their life had been snuffed out in the womb, as so many thousands are. And I think my friend was exactly right. Collectively, our culture doesn't think there's anything significant or special about humanity. And so our culture has little respect and diminishing respect for human life. So former Senator Bob Brown can even refer to human beings, to people, as simply being fellow Earthians. But according to Psalm 139, how wrong our culture is and how wrong Bob Brown is. Because Psalm 139 teaches us, doesn't it, that we're tremendously significant. The psalmist praises God in verse 13. He says, for you, God, formed my inward parts. You knitted me together in my mother's womb. I praise you, for I am fearfully and wonderfully made. Friends, the psalmist and every one of us was specifically and specially made by God. Each human life, friends, is a specific creative work of the true and living God. Each one of us, verse 14 then, is one of God's wonderful works. And while we were being made, we weren't hidden, verse 15, from God's eyes. Even when we were just a tiny, tiny cluster of cells, that is, even when, verse 16, our substance was as yet unformed, God knew us, God planned us, and he saw us. He knew us as a person, as one of his image bearers, which gives us magnificent dignity. And he knew us as one to whom he'd give a destiny, verse 16. We read, in your book, in God's book, were written every one of them, every single one of them, the days that were formed for you, when as yet there were none of them. From conception, our all-knowing, all-seeing, ever-present Creator set the span of our life. He gave us our life, and one day he'll call time on our days when he chooses. The fact that God has specifically and fearfully and wonderfully made each one of us reassures us, doesn't it, of our very great significance. And the fact that we know that God will limit our days is a gain for our spiritual safety. We'll make sure, won't we, by God's grace and with the power of his Spirit, we'll make sure that we're spiritually prepared for that day when each of us will meet God face to face as judge. God's comprehensive, specific knowledge of the psalmist, including his very setting of the number of days of his life, is too much for the psalmist. We read in verse 17, how precious or how formidable or how difficult to me are your thoughts, O God. How vast is the sum of them. If I were to count them, they are more than the sand. God knows the psalmist infinitely better than he knows himself. The psalmist is saying here that even if he spent every waking hour puzzling over God's specific knowledge of him, even if he spent every waking hour puzzling over God's knowledge of his ways and his days, he still would not understand himself as well as God understands him. And so he basically decides that it's better for him just to rest in knowing his significance and knowing his safety comes from the true God. The true God who sees him and knows him and who's with him everywhere, who brought him into existence and who'll one day take him out. And so it's better, actually, just for the psalmist, rather than trying to puzzle over all the details of God's knowledge of him, it's better just for the psalmist to recommit himself to God as God is committed to him. So he says in verse 18b, after trying to fathom all God's ways, he says, I awake and I am still with you. God's with him and he acknowledges that he's with God. And so the psalmist's self-conscious commitment to God explains the very strong language that we might be surprised to see in verse 19 to 22. So the psalm's been going very nicely to this point, but we get to verse 19 and there's a bit of a crunch. But here the psalmist, who commits himself to God, he gives expression to that by saying that he wants nothing to do, verse 19, nothing to do with wicked people. He describes them as those murderous men of blood who speak against God, verse 20, with malicious intent. He speaks of those who are God's malicious enemies who take his name in vain. In fact, surprisingly, we might think, surprisingly in verse 21, he even says that he hates God's enemy. And here it's important for us just to think about this for a moment. See, the psalmist's hatred here is not personal vindictiveness. It's not hatred that's driven by a personal agenda. It's not petty hatred. No, the psalmist's hatred here stems from something else. It stems from a very deep loyalty to God. In fact, because the wicked or the men of blood are fundamentally God's enemies, the psalmist, verse 22, goes as far as saying that he counts them as his enemies. He's that loyal to God. And, of course, that's quite shocking language for us. It's perhaps language we're not really used to reading. But perhaps we shouldn't be shocked by it. Because Jesus himself uses similar language in the New Testament, doesn't he? So when Jesus describes the sort of loyalty that people should show to him, he speaks of hatred. In Luke 14, verse 26, Jesus says, "If anyone comes to me and does not hate his father and mother and wife and children and brothers and sisters, yes, and even his own life, he cannot be my disciple." So friends, here Jesus is saying to us that our loyalty to Jesus must be such that if our family draws us away from him, or if our family stands between us and him, then even our natural human love and affection for them must be as if it were hate compared to our love for Jesus. We must love Jesus first and foremost. So the psalmist, being quite straightforward, he says that he hates God's enemies. But even though that's the case, he doesn't pretend, though, does he, that he doesn't have sin in his own life. So he doesn't pretend that he's got it all together. He doesn't pretend that he doesn't have the potential at times to behave as an enemy of God himself. He's very aware, isn't he, of the fickleness of his own heart. So as a genuine believer, but a flawed believer, he wisely checks his heart. In fact, he pleads, doesn't he, from verse 23, he pleads with God to check his heart for him. So he says, verse 23, "Search me, O God, and know my heart. Try me and know my thoughts, and see if there is any grievous way in me, and lead me in the way everlasting." And so, as believers, brothers and sisters, we would do very well, wouldn't we, to take a leaf out of the psalmist's book, to regularly get before God and to pray this prayer of verse 23 to 24. To ask God to search our hearts, to reveal to us our sin, even the sin that we're blind to, so that we might grow in holiness, that we might grow in our relationship with him, that we might grow in conformity to the Lord Jesus Christ. So friends, in Psalm 139, we have a genuine believer who has a real relationship with the true and living God. And he's completely blown away by the fact that the true God absolutely knows him and sees him completely, that he's with him always, that he specifically made him for himself. And he's genuinely delighted that he genuinely delights in God's knowledge of him and presence with him. You see, even if he was the poorest and lowliest man on earth, this believer understands that he has profound significance because he's known by and seen by and made by and accompanied by the true and living God. And there's also great spiritual safety as well as significance for this believer in being known and seen so closely by God. Because even as a believer, at times we're all still tempted, aren't we, by darkness and by the deeds of darkness. But knowing that God is there and that he does see, it gives this believer and all believers great incentive, especially when we're at our weakest, great incentive to flee sin and to flee darkness. So, friends, as a New Testament believer, if you're a genuine believer in the Lord Jesus, please understand that you are known by God, that you're watched over by God. And we read about it in John 10, didn't we? In John 10, verse 11, we read that Jesus is the good shepherd, that as a believer, he's your good shepherd and he watches over you. He laid down his life for his sheep, believers like you and I, who trust in him for our salvation. As a believer in Jesus, you can truly rejoice that he knows you, John 10, 14. He knows all about you. He sees you. He watches over you for your good. He holds you in his hand. He's with you wherever you are by his Spirit. You're wonderfully significant to Jesus, not simply because he made you, but because he's redeemed you. In Jesus and through Jesus and because of Jesus, you're absolutely significant and you are entirely safe. So my brother, my sister, whatever you do this year, stay close to Jesus. Don't ever flee from Jesus. Don't ever hide from him.